Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm so glad you can join us for a few minutes today to talk about some classic baseball cards and a very classic set for a number of reasons. It's a personal favorite of mine for a number of reasons, but it's also a favorite of a lot of hobbyists. Some people don't like it, but I would say overall, most people do. 77 Tops. And it's a set that would be one of the last really creative sets for Topps in the 1970s. They had a pretty good run in the 70s, and I would dare say a stretch of some glory years, too, from, well, even 1970, even though I wasn't a big fan of that set. You could say 70 to 77, 71 to 77, 74 to 77, even though you've got the loud 72 and 75 sets in there. But the production values would dip a little bit in 78 and 79 and even into 1980. So 77 may be the last of the really creative sets that Topps did in the 70s. And we've got an interesting random pull here. Card number 301, Toby Hera. And I've always thought that Toby Hera was an underrated player, even though he was an all-star the season before. But he was often one of only maybe three decent players, first with the Washington Senators, later with the Texas Rangers. You could argue he was the only decent player with the Cleveland Indians in the early 1980s. And when he went back to Texas in the mid-80s, you could argue that he was the only decent player then, as the Rangers were once again loading up. This was before the days of Ruben Sierra and Juan Gonzalez and Nolan Ryan and you know, Ivan Rodriguez. They were struggling a little bit in the mid-80s. But Toby Hera was a very underrated player, but there are some people who say he is vastly underrated and is better than some Hall of Fame infielders. That I don't necessarily agree with, but we'll talk a little bit about that conversation as well as the battle that goes on between the advanced analytics crowd and the old school stat busters. So we'll talk about that. Toby Hera, 77 Tops. And I just want to welcome in all of our new listeners. I've been following our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Picked up a lot of new listeners this past week. And we'll welcome in a select few who commented on our timeline. But first, I want to let you know that I do not necessarily talk through my nose. I'm still getting over this very, very stubborn, minor but stubborn sinus infection that I got about a week ago. And it's just one of those things where it wasn't major. It wasn't like my head was hurting, you know, for several days, or I've been, you know, just a faucet of snot. That is not the case. It's just one of those things. I had this little infection, kind of went away after two or three days, but it's still in some parts lingering. And I hate it because it's either deep in your nasal cavity, causing me to have this nasally voice today, or it settles in your chest, which is even worse because then you're coughing for 3 weeks and you feel fine. You look fine. You're certainly doing better than when you first got it. But it's just one of those, you know, sinus infections, colds that just has a little piece still lingering in there. So once again, bear with me. I'm not in Susan Plachette mode like I kind of was in last week's episode, but still getting over it. And hopefully by the time we move on to 78 Tops next week, I will be back to my quote-unquote normal self. Now let's take a look at our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stain. It's a very active week this week. I mentioned we've got some new people following along. We'll welcome you in just a little bit. But first, let's talk about the 76 Tops podcast, which a lot of our fans were very excited about. Not necessarily the podcast, but the conversation of 76 Tops, which I argued could be the best set that Tops released in the 1970s. Now, there is no doubt that they pulled the best elements from these 73, 74, and 75 sets, and a lot of people loved that. In fact, even before the podcast came out, we had some people pretty excited about it, including Robbie T., mentioning he was just telling a story at the National Card Show. Well, you've got to tell stories about that. I hope that went well for you. He was telling a story at the card show, a gathering, about his grandma sending a box of 76 tops to him in 1979 when he lived in Spain. It was a birthday gift. Love him. That is awesome. You got a box. I don't know if it was a box of wax packs or cello packs or just a box of random cards there, but that's awesome. Shaw Law Offices, 1976 was an incredible year in our country, too. So much fun. And I mentioned, you know, it was rather fortuitous that we happened to just pull the Rick Monday card because that was the bicentennial and his heroics and rescuing the American flag from the protesters at Dodger Stadium. And the subsequent celebration from Dodgers fans, you know, that was just, you know, not only patriotism all wrapped up in that one year, but after years and years and years of just depressing national news, including the Vietnam War and Watergate and just the malaise that had kind of settled in on the country at that time, economic factors and the long lines at gas stations, you know, the OPEC issues, you know, something like that was stirring patriotism in a summer that would be truly patriotic. Also, SD in the Ville cards replying, love the set. My weekly allowance in 1976 was a rack pack. Identify strongly with my childhood. Well, I'm glad we were able to bring back some great childhood memories there, too. And, you know, that actually begs the question. I'll throw this out there. What set really brings back your childhood? Now, this isn't a question of what's your favorite set or what is the best set. We've done that before. But what set of baseball cards strongly identifies with your childhood? That's a pretty good question there. I could think of a few, but I will put out 87 tops, and I've told this story before, but let me just try to get the conversation going here. In the summer of 1993, I would take my weekly allowance, which for my family was just a few dollars doing household chores, but I would also make like $15, I think, mowing the neighbor's yard. And growing up in Florida in the summer, your yard has to be mowed every week. You let it go more than a week, and it's a jungle out there. So I had some elderly neighbors a couple doors down from me, basically from May through September. I would mow their yard every week and get $15 for it. And you do the math there. That's what, 5 months, 4 weeks in a month there. You know, you can make some pretty mad money. That's not bad if you're, you know, 15, 16 years old like I was at the time. And I would often take that money and go to a local card shop. And we had plenty of them where I grew up. I mean, not so much nowadays. But one card shop that I frequented the most had a lot of wax boxes and cello boxes, and I used to buy boxes of 87 Topps cello packs. And of course, it would take a couple of yard mowings to get the money to purchase these. I think they were $20 at the time, or maybe $25. But I couldn't tell you how many hours I spent that summer assembling all of these cards. And of course, in 1993, a lot of the game's great players were very well represented in 87 Topps. Not only, you know, rookie cards like McGuire and Canseco and Bonds, even Bo Jackson had made his comeback then. He was playing with the White Sox at the time. But some veteran players, you know, Nolan Ryan was still playing, Ricky Henderson, Paul Molitor, Dale Murphy was in Colorado at the time. I mean, there were a lot of veteran star player cards in 87 Topps that were still quite pertinent to the world of baseball 6 years after they were released. So even though 87 Topps came out before I started collecting in 1989, and I certainly connect with 89 Topps because that was the first card set that I, or first cards that I bought, the first packs that I bought, which got my collecting going. 87 Topps is the one I connect with the most because in one particular summer, I collected it the most. I ended up putting together two or three sets, selling them at garage sales too. So I was able to make some of my money back. So that's my story, and I'll let you share yours on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gumstains. Again, which baseball card set, not your favorite, not the best, but which one identifies your childhood the most? I would love to see the responses there, because I know we've got people of all ages listening, and various reasons why one set stands out amongst the others. Now, we do have some new people following along here. The Milwaukee Mauler downloaded a couple of podcasts to check you out. I'll let you know what I think. I collect all A's, but mostly tops. And he continues, I have completed my collection from my youth, 76 through 81, 84. Currently interested in 73 and 75, but I don't know. And Hostess. And he chuckles after that. I was never one, and we even did a podcast on this a while back about logo-free cards and cereal box cards and stuff like that. You can look through our archive on audioboom.com or iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or TuneIn. I believe it'd be around episode 67, I want to say. In between the 1993 cards and 1954, we did a couple of offshoot podcasts. But there are some people that love collecting the Hostess cards or the Post cereal cards, or you name it. So I'm sure if you reach out on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, you'll find somebody that's got some excess Hostess cards laying around. I'm sure that you guys can get a deal done. Jay Wigley responds, I'm enjoying the podcast. So engaging. Well, thank you very much, Jay. He asks, what's the Twitter feed for the card backs guy? I love the backs as much as the fronts. Well, for everybody, the card backs guy, which I did refer to in our last podcast on 76 Tops, is Baseball Card Backs. The handle is Sport Card Backs. So that's singular sport, singular card, and then plural backs. And Baseball Card Backs actually responded, thank you. I only hope I can live up to your expectations. Well, as you know, we keep the bar pretty low here on Wax Ecstatic, so don't expel too much energy concerning about meeting any expectations. Chances are you already have. And by the way, Baseball Card Backs does a great job posting random cards and some very interesting things. Even though we disagree on certain card sets, it's always a very interesting conversation, especially some of the card backs that he'll just throw up at a moment's notice. We were talking about Homer Bailey and Willie Ansley in our last podcast about some very interesting card backs, and he's got plenty more to share. Also, welcome aboard, Jeremy Conrad. Just discovered the show. I am loving it. Thank you for providing so much history for our hobby. Well, I'm glad that I could provide that for you, Jeremy, as you know, this is a labor of love. And as you'll hear the sales pitch later, you know, I do appreciate cash tips to help keep the podcast going. And we also do lots of other fun things like doing the auction breaks. But, you know, really the key thing is, it was just this idea that started a little over a year ago. Believe it or not, we celebrated our one-year birthday. I want to say it would have been in late July. I don't know the exact date, but I do know it did pass a couple weeks ago. And, you know, it's been an interesting experience for me as a host because, in all honesty, and if you listen to episode one in our archive, in all honesty, when I started this, I joked, I said, well, it'll last about 5 weeks and just die a horrible death. Much like many other side projects I've done in my life. And that's the truth. You know, I come up with some great ideas and we get them going. And then just for one reason or another, it just doesn't go anywhere. But this certainly has. And I think one of the reasons why is even though I do not collect baseball cards to the veracity that I did when I was a teenager, and I quite literally had 50,000 sports cards in my possession when I was a teenager in my early 20s. You know, I got rid of a lot of them, many, many years ago. And it's, you know, mostly junk wax era cards and common cards and just stuff that I didn't want to cart around from one home to another. But I got back into it mostly because of my son, you know, several years ago wanted to expose him to baseball cards. And, you know, I got right back into the habit of buying a pack every now and then. But, you know, it's a very special connection that I have not only to my childhood, but to baseball fans too. And I love the sport of baseball. Yes, I work for a hockey team for a living. I love hockey. But baseball is the yin to my yang for my workplace activities on the rink. So it's fun to be talking baseball. It's fun to be looking back at these sets. It's fun to get your hands on some of these older cards. And one of the big purposes of this show is for collectors to take a second look at what they may have neglected. Now, of course, when you're talking vintage cards from the 50s through the 70s, you know, there's a little more reverence paid to those particular sets because, you know, this was before Topps had the competition from Fleer and Donruss in the 1980s, and then before the junk wax explosion in the late 80s and into the early 90s. So, you know, there's a little more reverence for those cards because there's not as many of them that are out there. And it was when the hobby was still, most of the time, still truly a hobby and not really a business like it is now. But I've got to say, it's fun looking back at a lot of these sets and some of the stories behind the players. And even from those sets in the 80s and 90s, and I've said this before and I'll say it again, and I hope that, you know, some listeners follow my thinking here. Some of the sets that we knocked back then and some of the sets that we still knock now are not as bad as people have made them out to be. Now, if you're looking to make a fortune off some of these sets, especially the junk wax era sets, well, forget about it. You're not even 89 Upper Deck has its limits. You know, the Ken Griffey Jr. card, you know, people were, you know, storing those away, you know, cases of those in warehouses thinking that, you know, one day they'd be able to just sell off these cases and, you know, retire as a millionaire. Well, you know, the market didn't really set itself that way. I mean, yeah, you could still get a pretty penny for some of those number one cards from the 89 Upper Deck set, but it's not like it was back in the day when those cards were worth $50, $60 a piece and you could retire off of a large quantity of unopened Upper Deck product just sitting in your garage. But, you know, there are a lot of sets from, you know, in particular 88 through 93, but I would even say throughout the 80s, when you take a second look, you go, you know what? They actually tried something different here, or they tried something cool. And you know, like I'm a big fan of 91 Bowman, and I've made this argument before. In fact, it was one of our flashback episodes recently, 89 Bowman. I said, you know, you look at some of the things that Bowman tried to do in 89, 90, and 91. Okay, maybe you didn't really like the overall look, or maybe you didn't like the fact that it wasn't as valuable as an Upper Deck card. But there are some good things to some of those early Bowman sets. Likewise, you know, there's actually some good qualities to some of the flimsy Donruss cards of the 1980s. There's some good qualities to some of the, you know, rather businesslike and conservative Fleer cards from the 1980s. So I really enjoy looking back at some of these sets, and even I learn a few things from doing this show, and I have a whole new appreciation for some sets. Like, it wasn't until I got into, you know, like the 92 Fleer Ultra and some of the Stadium Club cards from 91 and 92. You know, I liked those cards back then, 25 years ago. But when I took a second look at them doing these podcasts, I realized how incredible and how advanced those cards were. And because it's from the junk wax era, you can get these Fleer Ultra and Top Stadium Club cards, even 93 Bowman, 92 Bowman, you know, sets that took a giant leap forward in quality you know, special niches. Because they're from the junk wax era, you can get wax boxes or foil pack boxes, if you wish. You can get boxes of packs of cards for as little as $10 these days because there's just so much product that's out there. So, you know, as long as you're not concerned about trying to make a buck off some of these cards, you just want to look at some great cards and probably stir up some great memories too, you can do that. So I'm really glad that we've not only picked up quite a few more listeners over the last few weeks, but you all are enjoying the podcast. Thank you very much for chiming on in. And one last comment from our Twitter feed, our good buddy. I love this. It's not his handle. It's his name though. Dr. Funky Butt Lovin' also known as Stratty D. He actually sent some pictures this past, when was it, Thursday, I believe. He had what we call a good mail day. He gets a couple of packages in the mail, and he shows off some of the cards he has, including 66 tops Lou Brock, 67 tops Rod Carew, and then a whole plethora of cards here. I see a 76 Brett, a 66 Richie Allen, 72 Reggie Jackson, Doc Ellis also from 72, Willie Stargell from 68 and 71. Oh, I see a 77 Doc Ellis as well. 69 Bob Gibson, 73 Nolan Ryan, 77 Reggie Jackson, 82 Lou Whitaker. And he was not only proud to have these cards in his collection, but as the conversation went on, somebody said, well, how much did you pay for these? And he alluded to the 72 tops Jackson he got for a dollar. And this just goes to the heart of what I've been saying throughout our travels through the big old binder of baseball cards. And that is the cards from 1954 that I have through 1980. Especially when you're looking at cards from the 50s and 60s and early 70s, which are a lot harder to find, certainly in mint condition. Don't worry about the condition. See what you can find out there. You'll be amazed at some of the deals and discounts that dealers and local card shops will give you on some of these vintage cards, especially if they're not in mint condition, because the only way a card shop makes money off of a vintage card is if the card is in gem mint or, you know, somewhere in that neighborhood. You know, I would say like a PSA 7.5 and above. That's the only way that a card shop could make some money off of a 67 Rod Carew. And then you've got to hope that there's somebody out there that wants to spend the money for a PSA 8 or 9 67 tops Rod Carew. If you find a 67 tops Rod Carew that's in a very good or excellent condition, that card shop dealer, he may let you have it for $2 or $3. Even though if you look up the book price and you look at market prices and, you know, you meticulously look at the grading, you know, it could be technically worth $10. You can probably get it for a discount because, again, the dealer's not going to make that much money off of a card that is in lesser condition. So if you're not concerned about trying to make a fortune off these cards and you just want to have some great cards of great players from, let's be honest, hard-to-find sets, and that describes the 50s and 60s and especially the early 70s, as long as you're not concerned about condition, you can get some great deals on these cards. And I've found that too. You know, I've bought lots of, you know, 100, 200 cards from the throughout the 60s and 70s, and I haven't paid more than $20 or $30 for these lots. And there are some star cards in there, and there's also some commons too. But as long as you're not too concerned about the condition and you just want to have some great players and great sets in your hands, by all means, do it. Now, if you want to comment about anything we discuss on this podcast, or if you want to join the conversations that others have started, you could do so at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Also on our Twitter feed, keep an eye out for a few things. One, our next auction item, this is going to be pretty exciting. Now, we had a pretty exciting auction this past weekend with a series of wax packs. I was able to cobble together a couple different sales, and we had 281 Donruss, 282 Donruss, and 285 Donruss wax packs. And it's always fun to go ripping through those, despite the fact that the gum in the 81 Donruss has turned into some slightly nuclear chemical reaction that has destroyed cards. But we were able to pull some good ones out of there. I know a lot of our collectors will really like this. Our next item up for bids, I have not gotten it in hand yet. I'm expecting it in the mail probably today, maybe even tomorrow. But I have procured a 1979 Topps Cello Pack. The 79 Topps Cello Packs had 17 cards in them. Of course, the big card that everybody goes for is the Ozzie Smith rookie card. With Topps problems of, you know, often cutting cards off center. It's hard to find them in gem mint condition, so maybe we'll strike it rich and grab one of those. But you also have a lot of early career cards for a lot of the stars of the 80s, including Jack Morris, Gary Carter, Dale Murphy, Robin Yount, George Brett, Paul Molitor, Lou Whitaker, you name it. There's a lot of incredibly talented players from the 1980s. And then, of course, your veteran stars. You've got your Pete Rose, your Mike Schmidt, your Nolan Ryans, your Steve Carlton's, Carlton Fisk. So I'm very excited. I've mentioned before trying to find some late 70s and early 80s packs for us to auction off and then break and deliver the cards to a winner. It's been kind of hard because the market's been a little high recently, and I can't quite figure out why, but the prices have been a little higher than what I would want to pay. Well, I was able to get a good deal on the 79 Topps pack. And the auction price, it will be a little higher than normal. You know, normally our auction for the six wax packs of the early Donruss releases started at $10. This one will probably start at $35, maybe $40, because it was a little pricier to attain. But again, if you land something big in there, especially the Smith card, but even those early career cards, like I mentioned, Brett and Yount and, Carlton Fisk and Dale Murphy and those guys, you can get a few dollars for those cards, and I think it'll be worth it. It is not easy to find unopened product from the late 70s. I'm very happy that I was able to get this. And as long as I can get this stuff at a decent price, you know, sure, I could go out and spend $150 on a 1970 Topps pack in the hopes that somebody listening to this podcast would spend $150 to obtain it themselves and, help me offset the cost of getting that pack. But I also know that there's only a handful of collectors out there that have that money as part of their disposable income. So sure, it'd be fun to purchase that and open it and deliver those cards to somebody, but we also have to keep some realistic expectations on what we can deliver. So 79 Topps Cello pack, that will be going up for bids this upcoming weekend. So keep an eye out for that message. Also, you may have already seen this throughout the past few days, but we do have a new Wax Ecstatic survey that is going out. And I want to know what you think about our show and what direction we should go in. It's hard to believe. I didn't realize this until I was kind of revising the questions from our previous survey. But our previous survey was done back in February. It was 6 months ago. I thought it was a lot sooner than that. But that survey helped guide Wax Ecstatic to what it is now. And, you know, doing the auction breaks, that was a suggestion. Also, you know, doing the podcast once a week as opposed to twice a week, which is what we started with, was another suggestion. And then the suggestion to go from the big old monster box to the big old binder, going from the junk wax era cards to the vintage cards, that was the direction that our listeners pointed us into. So we're doing a lot of the same things there. You know, we just want your thoughts about the program, your thoughts about the content, your thoughts about the host. I know you like him. And also your thoughts about where do we go from here? We do have several options. And of course, the ubiquitous other option, which you can tell us. And we're just curious, about your listening habits to this program. We want to not only make sure we're going in the right direction, but we want to keep doing things the right way, the way that you would prefer them done. We had a pretty good turnout last time when we did the survey 6 months ago. I would imagine because we have picked up a lot more listeners since then, we'll have a bigger audience. So even if you took the survey back in February, please do so this time. I want as many responses as possible, not only because it makes it a fair representation of the audience, but it's also good just to get input from everybody. And those answers that have the most weight behind them, that is likely the direction that we go in. Of course, I am the creator, executive producer, and host of this program. So I will have the final say on what we do, but I'd certainly appreciate all the information and advice that you can give me that will help shape my decision-making with this program. And one last thing about wax and gum stains, you can always look for this. We'll tweet this out once or twice a week. If you really want to show us how much you love us, go ahead and give us a few dollars in our tip jar. We actually have two tip jars. We're pretty greedy around here. By listener suggestion, we created a tip jar at Venmo. So venmo.com/waxecstatic. Haven't received any tips through there, but again, we had a couple people ask us when we started the tip jar a few months back if we accepted Venmo. Well, now we do. So if you're one of those Venmo people and you want to make a contribution, you have to be a friend of mine on Venmo. So go ahead and reach out to me. We'll connect and then you can make your donation. But also, we have our older tip jar available at PayPal, and it's at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. If you don't know how to spell wax ecstatic, just look at the podcast and you can see how the name is spelled, and go ahead and give us a tip. Again, even if it's as little as a couple dollars, or if you want to give us a few more dollars than that, everything is greatly appreciated. This is a labor of love, not looking to get rich off of this program, but there are some production costs involved in making it happen. Also, there are some costs in terms of time. This is a show that, you know, if it runs an hour long, that means it takes probably about 3 hours to assemble. So there is a little time. This is not my day job. I have to do this around my day job during my free time. And there is a little bit of blood, sweat, and tears put into it. So any donation, again, whether it's just a couple bucks or a little more, it is always greatly appreciated. All right, let's take a look at our set of the week, the 1977 top set. And this is a set that I have always been endeared to for a number of reasons, and I've shared them with you before. But since we're doing a show on the 77 top set, let me get a little more in detail on those reasons. I was born in 1977, and that is a very easy way to connect yourself to a set. If you were born in 1981, born in 1983, born in 1962, whatever year you were born in, there is at least one baseball card set that was produced in that year that you can connect yourself to. Even though you may not know the players, you may not remember any kind of history from that particular season, because after all, you were crawling around in diapers, then it doesn't really matter. You are connected to that set, much like you are connected to the events from that year. Now, I was born in October of 77, so I was actually born during the World Series between the Yankees and the Dodgers that year. I was also born during the Jimmy Carter administration, which has its pros and cons. And also, me working in radio and being a DJ in my previous life, I looked up what song was number one the week that I was born. And quite literally, the first week of a 10-week run at number one, Debbie Boone, "You Light Up My Life." So that's one of the downsides of when I was born. Had I been born a day before, I would have fallen under Mecco's Star Wars theme / Cantina band. That I could live with. Debbie Boone, no, not really. But anyways, I have that connection to 1977, and it's not just my birth year, but it's also the year that the Toronto Blue Jays were born. And the Blue Jays were my childhood team. I grew up with that team in the late 80s and in the early 90s. And I really, you know, loved the fact that I was born the same year the Blue Jays were born. Of course, their season was over by the time I was born. But it's a really, really neat connection to have. And, you know, that wasn't why I picked the Blue Jays as my favorite team when I was a kid. I really honestly don't know why I picked the Blue Jays. But, you know, that was just another reason why it was kind of cool. So if I've ever wanted cards of the first Toronto Blue Jays team, it would come from the 77 top set. And, you know, that's another neat connection between me and my childhood there. Well, what's interesting about the 77 top set is, even though the Blue Jays and the Seattle Mariners came into the league that year, Topps did not expand the set. It was still a 660 card set, and they still offered quite a few subsets, including the usual league leaders, also turn back the clock cards, playoff highlights, and your rookie cards, which came, the four picture rookie cards that were very popular with Topps in the mid 1970s. They continued that in 77. And one of the things that knocks the 77 set is the selection of rookies, because most of the big name rookies are on those multi-picture cards. You don't have the single rookie card for some key players from that time. And that includes Andre Dawson, arguably the biggest rookie from that set. Also Dale Murphy. You've got Jack Clark, you've got Dennis Martinez, and to a lesser extent, and this isn't to knock him too much, you've got Bruce Sutter. He had his own card, card number 144, and also the late Mark Fidrick in there as well. So the 77 set didn't necessarily have the rookie star power as some other sets, especially 1975, but it did have some big-name rookies on those panel cards. And it also had some pretty big star cards. Like I was discussing with 79 Tops, you had your Brett, your Yount, your Carters, your Johnny Benches, your Carlton Fisk, your Nolan Ryans, your Mike Schmidt, your Steve Carltons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So even though you don't have that out of the park rookie card like a George Brett in 75, like a Dave Winfield in 74, you still have some pretty impressive names with their rookie cards in that set, but also some pretty impressive established players by 1977. And as we look at the card in our random pull, again, card number 301 for Toby Hera, I've always liked the design for 77 Tops. Now, I know some collectors don't. I would still say, though, probably 75% of collectors like the overall look, design, and feel for 77 Tops. Now, I say 75% because I don't think this falls in the category of you like it or you don't. That is more of the 50-50 crowd, and that is more of the sets that we've discussed previously, like 69 and 70, and there's plenty of sets from the 1980s that fall into that category, like 81 and 82 Tops. You either like it or you don't, and it's kind of split down the middle with collectors who do like it and who don't. But I would still say a vast majority of collectors in general like 77 Tops. Is it as outstanding of a set in terms of design as 76 or 74 Tops? No. Is it annoyingly tacky or delightfully tacky as 72 Tops, or annoyingly tacky like 75 Tops in terms of design? No. But 77 Tops still holds its own after all these years with a pretty unique collection of elements that make it up. Specifically the back of the card. We'll get to that in a moment, but let's take a look at the front of the card. Up top you have in slightly italicized, very bold letters, the team name, Rangers. And of course this treatment was given to everybody else too. But you have the team name in one set of colors above the player's name, Toby Hera here, his name in pink letters, the Rangers in gold letters. But then you have this rather unique pennant up in the upper right-hand corner. And while pennants were used rather uniquely by Tops in previous sets, most notably 65 Tops, one of my all-time favorite sets, the pennant had the team name and kind of the alternate crest in it. And certainly 74 Tops, where you had this kind of a longer pennant showing the first and last name of the team, you know, the city and then the team name. And as we would see in 1980, something very similar, kind of with a sash pennant wrapped around the picture of the card. This pennant is used to show off the position of the player, in this case, shortstop. So it's a unique use of this flag, but it's something that really stands out, even though it's just in the upper right-hand corner. Now, you have the photograph takes up about 80% of the card. At the bottom of this particular card, it says AL All-Stars. Toby Hera was an All-Star in 1976. If you had a common player who was not an All-Star the previous year, you just didn't have this banner. You just had that extra, you know, eighth of an inch or whatever it is dedicated to the rest of the picture there. So you're not really missing anything if you didn't have this All-Star banner at the bottom of the card. You have the faux autograph, which was a very popular concept with Topps cards at this time. And then you have the picture of the player, and here is Toby Hera looking all mean and nasty, striking a batting pose at the Oakland Alameda Coliseum before they built Mount Davis. This picture likely taken during 1976. And you'll notice the photography with Topps They and I've never heard an official explanation to this, but I have this understanding that Topps employed not necessarily two individual photographers, but two photography firms, if you will, one that was based in New York and one that was based in the San Francisco, Oakland area, the Bay Area of California. So when you look at a lot of cards in especially the 70s, but this is true also in the late 60s, most of the pictures of players are either taken in Candlestick Park, Oakland Coliseum, Yankee Stadium, or Shea Stadium. Really, the only other locale that you had pictures taken was in spring training. So, you know, you see the occasional desert mountain or palm tree from Arizona or Florida, respectively. But I would say probably 99% of the cars that you see from this era were either from spring training, the San Francisco Bay Area, or the New York City area. And that's just because that's where the Topps company employed their photographers. Now, one reason why I tell you that is not only because that's one of the reasons why you see a lot of the Oakland Coliseum or Candlestick Park in the background, or Yankee Stadium or Shea Stadium, as the case may be, but if the player photographed was not playing for the home team, i.e. New York, San Francisco, or Oakland, you saw them in their road uniforms. And the Texas Rangers, I love their late 70s road uniforms. The powder blue, along with the more traditional patriotic red, white, and blue of the uniform at the time, is a winning combination. It looks really, really good, very similar to what the Minnesota Twins had at the time, although their blue was a little bit of a darker blue. The Rangers had more of a navy blue to their color scheme. But also the shoulder patch here. And if you zoom in on this picture, you see this is a bicentennial patch here. So it's Rangers 1776, 1976. And it just looks like it should say USDA on it somewhere. It is very Texas. It looks like it should be selling steaks and not baseball. But I love that alternate patch. That is just a beauty. And you can't really see it in this picture here, but the Texas font that was on the front of the jerseys, you know, the road jerseys for the Rangers went through several different variations, first when they arrived in 72 and then again in 74 and 75. I think on 76 they settled on this blue scheme, and it was one that they used through 1982. But I love the old west block Texas in red letters again up against this powder blue uniform. It is a great look. You see the Rangers occasionally use it on a turn back the clock day, and I wish they would use it more. I think it's a great look. Even though it is a little aged, I think it looks really, really good. And I think the front of these 77 Topps cards looks good too. I know some collectors don't like all of the space that's dedicated to frame, especially all the space dedicated to the team name, player name, and the position pennant at the top. But I like it because if you're like me, if you're old enough to remember what Polaroid pictures looked like, the actual Polaroid picture where you took the shot and the picture spit out of the camera, you know, now you can add that instant camera look to, you know, any picture you take on your iPhone. But the actual Polaroid picture, that's kind of what this card looks like. Kind of upside down, though, because the Polaroid had more of the white border space at the bottom. And that was by design. That was so that you could take that picture out of the camera, grab a pen or a marker, and scribble down some notes on the bottom of the picture there for the Instamatic photos. But it reminds me of a Polaroid picture. And that was very ubiquitous of the 1970s. And certainly some great photography and great design here in 77 Topps. So I think going with that Polaroid look, it goes hand in hand. It looks really, really good. Now, something else that looks really, really good, the backs of these cards. I have always loved 77 Topps. Curious what baseball card backs thinks. Let's flip the card over. You have the horizontal presentation, and you've got the player's name in big letters stretched across the top of the card. You've got his personal information just underneath it. And then you have a unique paneling here. You've got the baseball card number and a small baseball on the left side. That is bridged with a little cartoon, mostly with information about the player, but sometimes just a trivial factoid for baseball. In this case, Toby Hara has a Gene Tennis factoid on his card. You have the complete major league record on the right, and then if space permitted, you had the factoids about the individual player, here mentioning that Toby hit two home runs in a 7-0 win over the Twins in September of 76. It also mentioned that he was an all-star for the American League in 1976 as well. Now, the one feature that I really, really like about this, so it's a pretty unique layout, but look at the bottom of the card. You have these little things in the lower left and lower right-hand corner. I know it's confused some people. They thought it was like a gate or a fence. Well, it's not a gate or a fence. It is the legs to a billboard. That's right. 77 Tops was designed to look like a roadside billboard. How cool is that? Now, I know some people think it's kind of kitschy and they're not crazy about it, but that is pretty darn creative. Because you've got all of these stats, all these stories, all this information that you have to share on the back, and you can just list it out there like they had done in previous years. But somebody in the art department said, hey, we can arrange this to not only just work well together, but we can have some fun with it, make it look like it's a billboard. So Topps was not only saying, hey, our cards can look like a Polaroid photo, they can also look like a roadside billboard. And that is one of the most creative moments of genius, I think, in the design of Topps cards. Topps never really did anything like that to their card backs. It was normally just, you know, either straight up stats or some kind of collection of factoids and pictures and stuff like that. This is the only time that Topps really tried anything like this, and I absolutely love it. Again, some collectors, they're not crazy about it. They think it's kind of cartoonish, but I like how you take all this information, you put it in a nice, neat presentation, and then you kind of, you know, pull the sheet back a little bit and go, now wait, it's not just information, it's on a billboard. So in many ways, Topps was making this 2.5-inch by 3.5-inch card larger than life. Not just with the Polaroid look on the front, but a billboard look on the back. So the next time you have those 77 Topps cards, if you haven't noticed this before, hold the card so it looks like it should be on a billboard, and I think you'll appreciate the design even more. I think it's one of the real fun things about the 77 Topps set, and I'm really glad that they did it, because sometimes card backs are not as exciting to look at as card fronts, but this is definitely one of the things that stands out. Sometimes looking at the backs of the 77 cards are more entertaining than looking at the fronts, even though the front of the card is pretty good. But check out the 77 Topps backs if you've got a stack of these cards. I think you'll be entertained with the presentation, the whole billboard look. Now, the 77 Topps set, still relatively easy to get. This is really the first vintage set that you can still find in wax pack form. I don't really see cello packs for 77 Topps too often, but definitely wax pack form. Presuming that they haven't been resealed, you can normally find some pretty good deals on these. We actually auctioned off a 77 Topps set, or Topps pack, excuse me, several weeks ago. But the 77 Topps packs you can find unopened. Typically, you can get them for about $25 to $30, sometimes a little more than that. And you can still find wax boxes. Anything before 77, though, is very, very difficult to find. You can find some 76 packs. You can find typically 75 Topps mini, not the regular size. Normally, the mini packs are out there a lot. And occasionally, you'll see a 74 Topps pack available for sale. But 77 Topps is the oldest vintage era card, or oldest card, because, you know, some people cut off vintage between 73 and 74. But 77 Topps is pretty much the oldest pack that you can find out there at a somewhat reasonable price. Once you get past those mid-70s, then, you know, if there's a truly unopened pack, you're looking at sometimes $80, $90, and then some for the pack, depending on the year. You know, $80, $90, that's for the 70, 72 or 73 top sets. You know, anything before that, you're paying a lot of money for those packs. So you can still find 77 tops in pack form. If you've got a lot of money, you can buy an unopened box. I have seen those available, those that have been PSA certified and sealed in saran wrap and plastic for your protection. But also, 77 Tops does have the bugaboo of missed cuts. Not quite as bad as you saw in like 75 and 76, but that is something that does stick around with Tops. Also, I did not know this until recently, but for whatever reason, Tops used a thinner cardstock in 77. I've got to look at this again, you know, compare a 75 and a 76 with a 77 or 78, but apparently they used a slightly thinner, more flimsy cardstock, and that has caused some very fuzzy cards all these years later, and that I can attest to. It is very easy if you've got a stack of 77 or 78 or 79 Topps cards. They're just sitting in a box, even if you take good care of them. Just, I mean, they're 40 years old. They do show a little wear and tear a little easier than some other cards. So be aware of that. Be aware that there are certain cards, because of constant miscutting, they are very hard to find in mint condition. In particular, Thurman Munson's card. I've also read Catfish Hunter, Tom Seaver, a couple of the star player cards that are hard to find in gem mint because those were the ones that were frequently miscut. And also, there are some cards, because it was a 660 card set and the way that the cards were cut, there are some cards that are double printed, so just beware of that. There may be some players that you think should be more valuable than what they are listed for. Now, Toby Hera should get a lot more credit for being a better ball player than it is acknowledged he is. He was one of the few decent players to play for the Texas Rangers, and before that, the Washington Senators, and arguably the best player for the Cleveland Indians in the early 1980s. But there are some arguments that he should be placed higher than some of the more better-known names in baseball, which I'm not agreeable to. But let's talk a little bit about Hera's career. He was born in West Virginia, but grew up in LaRue, Ohio. And he was scouted by several teams. He was a star in high school baseball. But he was telling teams, well, I'm going to be going to college. So a lot of teams, and this is in the mid-1960s, a lot of the teams were scared off because the amateur draft was a new thing back then. They didn't want to, you know, waste a draft pick on a guy who claimed that he was going to go to college and wouldn't be eligible for the draft. More succinctly, would be eligible for the draft, but if he had his sights set on college, he was not likely to be drafted because he probably wouldn't sign with the team that drafted him. So he scared off a lot of teams. Well, one day, a scout working for the Philadelphia Phillies found out that Hera was not actually playing college ball. He was working in a factory. Yeah. He was working in a factory in Marion, Ohio. The scout Tony Lucadello found out that he was not attending school and said, well, what the heck? Might as well just sign you. So he was signed by the Philadelphia Phillies in 1966. Now, in 1967, Major League Baseball had a minor league draft. Back in the day before free agency, there were several intra-league drafts, and that's how some players move from one organization to another. And the Washington Senators were able to pluck Hera away from the Philadelphia Phillies, so he moves up into the Washington Senators system, makes his way up to the big leagues in 1969, and became a regular fixture with the team in 1971. He appeared in 127 games that season, the final season that the Senators were in Washington. And Hera is actually part of some interesting Washington Senators history. He was the last Senators player to have an at-bat before the season concluded. And I've told the story before where the Senators' final game at RFK Stadium, because it was known that they were folding up shop and moving to Texas the next year, fans rioted. They ran out in the field. They started, ransacking the stadium, and the game had to be forfeit in the top of the ninth inning and you know, they couldn't complete the game. So Haro was the last batter in Washington Senators history, Washington Senators 2.0 history, as he was the final out in the eighth inning, and then the game got canceled in the ninth inning. So you can wow your friends with that very interesting piece of history there in Toby Harris' career. Now, the Washington Senators become the Texas Rangers, and Toby Haro becomes an all-star shortstop. 116 games in the 1972 season. He hits 259. Also, wasn't known for his power. He could pick up extra bases, though. But it wasn't necessarily his offense that grabbed people's attention. It was his fielding. He was a heck of a fielder and did play all of the 72 season at shortstop, although later on in his career, he would be used in various positions at third base. And also, when he got a little older, he was predominantly a designated hitter. But he was one of the few decent players on a otherwise shoddy 72 Texas Rangers team, and he did represent them in the All-Star game in Atlanta in 1972. Had some pretty average seasons in 1973 and 74, but again, as an All-Star in 75, he had one of his better offensive production seasons in 1975, hitting .293. That was his second best average in a season. His best season was 1982 with the Cleveland Indians, where he hit a career best .304. As you can see on this card, he was also an All-Star in 1976. Batting average dipped back down to .260, but he was starting to show his power numbers here, got the extra base hits, and was, again, not great, but a fairly consistent shortstop slash third baseman for the Rangers. Now, he was involved in a pretty big trade late in the 1970s, a trade that was pretty much seen as an even trade at the time. December 8th, 1978, the Rangers send him to Cleveland for Buddy Bell. So this was basically quite the able third baseman slash shortstop going from Texas to Cleveland for a quite able third baseman slash utility infielder in Buddy Bell. So at the time, people thought it was a pretty even trade. Didn't necessarily help the Rangers in the standings, and likewise, the Indians didn't get a big lift from having Toby Haro in the lineup. But that wasn't Toby Haro's fault. You know, the Indians never really had any kind of decent pitching staff. Although it should be mentioned that in Len Barker's perfect game against the Blue Jays in 1981, Toby Haro made a phenomenal play on a ball that would have been foul along the third baseline stands, but he, you know, reached into the stands and grabbed the ball for an out, thus helping preserve what would turn out to be the perfect game for Len Barker. As I mentioned, an all-star in 1982, best career numbers. He appeared in all 162 games with the Indians, had that .304 batting average, again, a consistent glove and a relatively consistent power bat. The Indians finally move him just before the start of the 1984 season, several players going back and forth from Cleveland and the Yankees, the most notable of those players, Otis Nixon, going from the Yankees to the Indians. So he was part of the Yankees in 1984, a team that was good but not great, didn't make the playoffs. His one season with the Yankees appeared in just 88 games, batting average slipped down to .217. Understandably, the Yankees didn't want to keep him around much longer, so they send him back to the Texas Rangers in a deal for a player to be named later, Eric Derson, who was a career minor leaguer. Also, Billy Sample went back to the Yankees, and in his final two seasons in Major League Baseball, he'd appear in 126 games with the Rangers in 1985, 95 games in 1986, hit .270 and then .218, respectively, over those two seasons before retiring at the end of the 1986 season when the Rangers granted him free agency. Now, Toby Haro was able to stay pretty active in baseball very quickly, in fact, in the Texas Rangers organization. He was the manager of their AAA affiliate, the Oklahoma City 89ers, in 1987 and 88. And from 1989 to 1991, he was first base coach for Bobby Valentine. And then he became a manager at the major league level, not necessarily by choice, although he was lining up for this when Valentine was fired Hera was the interim manager for the tail end of the 1992 season, where he went 32-44 over 76 games. This was also the year that the Rangers traded for Jose Canseco, that big blockbuster deal between the A's and Rangers at the end of the 1992 season. Now, after his time in Texas, he moved on to minor league managing once again, manager of the Norfolk Tides in 1995. He was a third base coach for the Cleveland Indians under Mike Hargrove. He replaced, you guessed it, Buddy Bell, the guy who he was once traded for. And in fact, you'll see the Hera and Bell connection quite a few times moving forward. Bell became the manager of the Detroit Tigers that year. That's why he moved on. That's why Hera moved on under Hargrove. Well, in 1997, Hera became a minor league hitting coach with the Tigers. And then the following season, 1998, he became the hitting coach under Buddy Bell with the Detroit Tigers, and also under Bell's replacement, Larry Parrish, who would be an interim manager later on that season. Now, Buddy Bell would become the manager of the Colorado Rockies in 2000, and guess who joined him on the coaching staff there? You guessed it, Toby Hera. He was the bench coach for the Rockies for three seasons there. And then Hera would find his way back into the Tigers system, first as a minor league hitting coordinator, a roving instructor later on, and then an unofficial coach, you know, kind of a guest coach under Jim Leland for a few years, because the Tigers, despite all the talent that they had at the bat, they did have some struggles offensively. So Hera was brought in to occasionally try to make the guys connect a little more often. And he has been away from the Tigers since the end of the 2013 season. Now, as I mentioned, there's a pretty big discussion about Toby Hera and his career. Now, as I've said, Hera was truly an underrated infielder. He was one of a handful of decent players on all the teams that he played for, both times in Texas, in Cleveland, and even that one year in New York with the Yankees. But there is an argument between the advanced stats people, you know, baseball, they call them sabermetrics, and the more traditional stats crowd. Now, I'm somebody who actually believes that the traditional stats people and the advanced stats people can coexist. I know, it's shocking. Yeah, I do believe that people can coexist. It is possible if you get past the embrace the debate feeling that we have been forced into over the last 10 or 15 years, not just in sports talk, but news channels on cable as well. So, you know, in an era where we are told that people who disagree with us are not only stupid and moronic, but they're quite possibly communist as well, I'm one of those few people that believe that you can not only coexist, but you can get things done together. So I'm a big believer that if you're a traditional stats person, it's okay to dabble a little bit in sabermetrics, because you may find an interesting stat or two that helps tell the story. And I'm one of those people who, you know, finally came around to taking the wins above replacement or the WAR stat a little more seriously, and it helps tell the story of a player's career. Likewise, if you are of the advanced stats crowd, don't poo-poo the traditional stats crowd. Sometimes a story can very simply be told through a simple stat. Fred McGriff once told me, baseball cards don't lie. You know, you can have all of the plaudits thrown your way from a general manager. A scout can tell you that you've got, you know, the most room for growth and you've got all the potential in the world, but baseball cards don't lie. Your stats are what you are. And, you know, sometimes no matter how advanced or how in-depth the stat can be, sometimes it's just the basic stat of on-base percentage or, you know, strikeouts to walk ratios or fielding percentage that help tell the story. So with that said, I'm not totally buying the argument that Toby Hera is not only underrated, but that he was one of the greatest infielders of our time. if you take certain sabermetrics, then Toby Hara is actually ranked higher than guys like George Brett or fellow shortstops like Barry Larkin and Cal Ripken. He does have a high wins above replacement number for a season, a pretty good war number for his career. But sometimes you just have to see the player for what he is. And again, while Toby Hara was underrated and certainly deserves a little more respect as a good player on some really bad teams throughout his career, I am not going to say that Toby Hara is equivalent or better than Cal Ripken or Barry Larkin or George Brett or you know, several of the other players if you do one, you know, advanced stats match up to the other. I think this is a case where he is what he is. Now, Cal Ripken Jr., I think, is a great example where he was in his prime, and we're talking late 80s into the early 90s, in his prime, he was a great player on some not so great teams. But if you took Cal Ripken Jr. out of the Baltimore Orioles lineup, there would be a massive, massive drop-off in the Orioles production. And that's saying quite a bit, some, you know, some of their, you know, worst seasons. I remember Cal Ripken Jr. was the American League MVP in 1991. And the Orioles, I think, had like 90 losses that year. And some people are wondering, well, how can an MVP come from a team that is just so bad? Well, if you look at the true definition of the MVP, you know, the best player in the league, and some will say the best player on a team, I've always given a lot of credence to the argument, if you took that player out of the lineup, the entire team would collapse without him. And you've seen this in sports where maybe it's due to an injury or maybe it's due to a trade or a contract dispute or whatever. When a certain player is not in the lineup, the team just cannot function without him. A great example from hockey a couple seasons ago, Carey Price, the goaltender for the Montreal Canadiens, was injured. And the Canadiens just did a massive nosedive that they just could not recover from. It was one of their worst seasons in franchise history. And that just goes to show the importance of one particular player. Well, the 1991 Baltimore Orioles were so bad, had you removed Cal Ripken from the lineup, then, you know, never mind losing 90 games. They probably would have lost 110. I mean, they were just not that good of a team back then. Now, if you do that with Toby Hara, if you remove him from some of the 1970s Texas Rangers teams, well, even though I knocked the Rangers for not being a really good team, you still had Jeff Burrows, you had Jim Bibby, you had Jim Sundberg, you know, later on you'd have Sparky Lyle. You know, you had some halfway decent players. Mike Hargrove is another one. They went in and out of Texas. Texas just couldn't consistently put together a good team. They had their moments, but they just could not keep a quality team together forever there. So if you remove Toby Hara, is he an important player for the Rangers? Absolutely. But the Rangers, you know, if they lost 90 games in the season without Toby Hara, they may lose 95. You know, the whole team wouldn't fall apart. But you're removing an important but not a cornerstone player for the team. Likewise, in his years in Cleveland, if you remove Toby Hara completely from the lineup, the Cleveland Indians still would have been a bad team. They wouldn't have, you know, again, you know, instead of losing 90 games, they probably would have lost 95 or 96. I don't think there's a 20 loss or 20 win swing with or without Toby Hara in the lineup. So I think when you just kind of look at it with a wide-angle lens here, yes, I know there are some stats that say that Toby Hara is one of the greatest infielders, and I can't say that with a straight face, But when you look at the wide angle lens, you look at the teams he was on, and then again, you look at just some of the basic stats. Toby Hara, who had an outstanding career, played 17 seasons in the big leagues. He played over 2,155 games. He had just under 2,000 hits. He had 1,954 hits. Still, here's a guy who, you know, his career batting average was 264, had some power, but was not known for his pop, averaged 15 homers a season. And more importantly, was not necessarily locked in at shortstop. You know, he was a utility infielder. He could be plugged in at third base. When he got older, he did see the designated hitter position in the lineup quite a bit. This is not kind of the anchor of a defense. This is a guy that you can move around. I think when you look at the career numbers, you look at the teams that he's on, you look at the impact, I don't buy the argument that you hear from the sabermetrics people saying that he was one of the, you know, top 25 infielders of all time. I just don't see that. Now, not to disrespect him, again, 17 years in the big leagues. Again, numerous all-star appearances. He was an all-star four times in his career. And he was a pretty consistent player. But he wasn't a great player. He was a consistently pretty good player. And there's no shame in that. And again, I don't think he gets the recognition he deserves. He was better than most people remember him for. And that's because a lot of people don't remember him because he was on some bad, bad teams. But to put him up there in the upper echelon of Hall of Fame players, that's an argument that I don't buy. And that's where you often have the clash of traditional versus advanced stats. Like I said, I think both can coexist and should coexist. But sometimes the over argument of one side for one case in particular kind of pushes the other side away. And, you know, when you have those arguments that are a little too tilted toward one thinking than the other, that's where you have that mismatch of standard or traditional statistics versus advanced statistics. And hopefully over time, that gap between the advanced and the traditional stats people gets a little closer. I don't know if they'll ever totally be in one. You know, it's kind of a Venn diagram. You'll have two circles that will eventually overlap a little, but they'll never be one on top of the other. But that's okay. It's good to have a little bit of a controversy, a little bit of discussion in this great sport of ours. But I'm not going to say that Toby Hara deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. He was a consistently very good player. 17-year career, as I mentioned, four times in the All-Star game. One of a few decent players, notably with Texas, had that great season in 82 with Cleveland. But even though he is underappreciated, I don't think you should overappreciate him just for the argument of one way you look at stats as opposed to the other. So there's my two cents there. Your thoughts about the 77 top set. Again, a favorite of mine for numerous reasons, but you know, not only just looks, but creativity on the back. And of course, the connection to my childhood team. Curious what you think about 77 tops. Toby Hara, the advanced stats versus the traditional stats argument. You name it. Throw it on out there at Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed. Make sure you join the conversation there. And make sure you join us next week as we move on to 78 tops, a very simple set, but a very ordinary set. There's some good and bad things about 78 tops. We will pick that set apart and also take a look at a random pull from there as well. And don't forget, as we're about to wrap up the big old binder, we do want your comments through our Wax Ecstatic survey. The link to that via SurveyMonkey will be available on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Tell a friend about Wax Ecstatic, won't you please? You've made it this far. God bless you. You've made it this far. We're almost done with the show. Tell your friends, even those who don't collect as much as they did back in the day, about Wax Ecstatic, about the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed, and let them know. We've got flashback editions on Friday. We've got new episodes on Tuesday. And our next new episode via Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and TuneIn will be coming your way next Tuesday, 10 o'clock Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I should say, as we will take a look back at the 1978 Topps set. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for joining me on Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.